Welcome to We've Got Issues. I'm Joshua Holland. This week, we're going to speak with journalist Ewan Marshall from Brazil. He's going to tell us about Brazil's own insurgency of dunces following the defeat of Jair Bolsonaro on January 8th, 2 days after the anniversary of our own insurgency. Then we'll be joined by Heather Digby-Parton, who is always a favorite guest on the show. But first, I want to just touch on the latest dumb front in the right's endless culture wars. God, it's so exhausting. And that is gas stoves and how the ostensibly neutral media have fed into this new controversy. This is an emerging line of bullshit. Last week, a headline writer at Bloomberg decided to get some clicks with a headline saying that the Consumer Safety Bureau was going to, quote, consider a ban on gas stoves. I don't know what that means, consider. But when I first saw that headline, I had two thoughts. First, that there was no chance that the federal government would simply ban gas stoves because that's not how we do things in this country. Even in New York State, where they are considering a so-called ban on gas stoves, it would only apply to new construction of multifamily buildings and it would phase in over several years. Second, when I read that headline, I knew that it would be fodder for a lot of very stupid right-wing demagoguery. I just knew that it was going to unleash a groundswell of derp. And sure enough, right-wingers are all pretending that they are Braveheart, standing tall against the insidious forces of woke whatever, and they are blathering on about how the government will have to take their gas stoves from their cold, dead hands. Now, this is totally predictable. And the reality is that the Inflation Reduction Act offers major subsidies to transition from gas to induction ranges. And you can even get thousands of dollars to upgrade your fuse box to accommodate that and other efforts to electrify your house. It's also the fact that gas stoves are associated with all kinds of respiratory ailments, as well as emitting greenhouse gases. And also, induction cooktops are not your father's electric stovetops. Chefs love them. They are super responsive. You can dial in the temperature perfectly. I can't wait to upgrade mine. by the way, the New York Times had an interesting piece this week about how Finnish schools teach media literacy as part of their core curriculum, with the ultimate goal of combating the effectiveness of propaganda. Finland lives right next to Russia. That's part of it. They have a world-class education system, perhaps the best in the world. We don't. And we don't teach this stuff to our kids. And it's depressing how gullible many Americans are to very obvious spin. You should know that the government isn't going to come and take your frickin' gas stove. Nobody is contemplating that. And that gullibility is not only true on the right, although studies show that they are more susceptible to disinformation. Speaking of which, and in related news, the New York Times also reported this week that, and I quote, a fossil fuel industry group that has been running a furtive campaign against government efforts to move heating away from oil and gas toward electricity made from wind, solar, and other cleaner sources is known as the Propane Education and Research Council, or PERC. And so they're pumping lots of money into this effort. And this is basically a dog bites man story, right? This is, you know, fossil fuel group promotes fossil fuels. It's not a big story. Except for two things. First, they're quietly paying celebrities and social media influencers to advance their pro-fossil fuel propaganda in a covert campaign, right? Second, if you use propane, you are paying for this campaign. And I don't use propane for a lot, but I have a propane barbecue. Like, I use propane. According to the Times story, and again, I quote, as a federally sanctioned trade association, PERC is allowed to collect fees on propane sales, which helps fund its marketing campaigns. According to the law that created the system, that money is supposed to be used for things like research and safety. End quote. But $13 million of those fees are going to this anti-electrification propaganda campaign. Finally, the next global climate conference, COP28, is getting underway right now. The Guardian reports that, and I quote, the United Arab Emirates will launch its presidency of the global climate talks on Thursday, with the head of its national oil company likely to be given the leading role. Jesus. According to The Guardian, Sultan Al-Jaber has served as climate envoy to the country and is chief of the Abu Dhabi National Oil Company, the world's 12th largest oil company by production, and he is going to take on the pivotal role of president of the talks. Now, central to that role is trying to pressure countries that have not yet submitted a climate plan under the Paris Accords to do so, but, and again I quote, many observers fear that UAE, as a major oil producer and with close ties to other producers such as Saudi Arabia, will be reluctant to take them on, which is, you know, no shit. Bit of an understatement, I think. There has been quite a bit of encouraging news on the climate front, but there are a lot of very powerful interests who are intent on making this planet hotter in order to maintain their profits. And it's just, this last little bit is just a bad joke. Anyway, on that happy note, let's take a quick break and then come right back with you and Marshall to talk about Lula's win and the reaction from the far right in Brazil. Stay tuned. I used to think, darling, you never did nothing, but you were always up to something, always had a running. I gotta think those days are coming to get you. Not nobody wanna protect ya. They only wanna forget ya. Welcome back. You know, I experienced a little deja vu this week when supporters of Jair Bolsonaro, Brazil's Trumpian, COVID-denying authoritarian crackpot, stormed multiple democratic institutions following Bolsonaro's widely anticipated loss to the leftist comeback kid, Lula da Silva. This happened just 2 days after the anniversary of the January 6th Confederacy insurgency of dunces here at home. A rejection of democracy that still poses a continuing threat today. By the way, this was the third attempt by the far right to take over a federal government in the past couple of years. People do not remember, I think a lot of people don't remember, the motley crew of German neo-fascists, and QAnon devotees, and anti-vaxxers attempted to storm the Reichstag in the fall of 2020. It was less dramatic than what went down in Washington, D.C., and then again this past week in Brazil, in part because it was a smaller crowd, but also because security services didn't downplay the threat, and they were prepared. Anyway, I am very pleased to be joined now by Ewan Marshall from Sao Paulo. Ewan is originally from Scotland, but he makes his home in Brazil. He covers Brazilian football as well as Brazilian politics. Ewan is a contributor to the Brazilian Report. He also freelances for a number of publications. Ewan Marshall, welcome to We've Got Issues.
Hi, Joshua. How are you doing?
I'm doing well. Thank you for taking the time to speak with me. The rioting in Brasilia was preceded by smaller actions by supporters of Bolsonaro. There were roadblocks in various communities, at least one bomb scare, big bomb scare. They were camped out in front of the military headquarters, calling for a military coup. And just as it was in the lead up to January 6th here in the U.S., the planning was very public. There were calls for, quote, a big party all over social media. Brazilian security forces are taking a lot of heat for not being prepared. To what degree was the violence foreseeable, and how big of a problem is it for Lula and for Brazil's democracy that Bolsonaro appears to have a lot of support in the country's police and military, and that many among that group appear to embrace the conspiracy theories about a stolen election?
Yeah, I think that just that last point there is very important, that the reaction to the Brasilia riots on Sunday has been, it's been quite, you know, quite widespread in terms of society and members of, you know, major institutions in Brazil condemning what happened. But at the same time, we're seeing opinion polls being released that while the majority did condemn what happened on Sunday, there are still roughly about 30 to 40% of people in Brazil who believe that the election was rigged, that the 2022 election was rigged, in which Lula beat Jair Bolsonaro by a slim margin, but still beaten by a couple of million of votes. So that kind of, that groundwork of just people believing that the democracy is completely rigged has created this very long movement ever since the election of these isolated demonstrations, roadblocks, as you say, protests in Brasilia and São Paulo and Rio de Janeiro, kind of leading up to what we thought, I think most people thought in the press and political analysts, thought was going to happen something on Lula's inauguration on January 1st. And nothing did happen on the inauguration. That was allowed to go smoothly. Lula was sworn in. Many people went to Brasilia in support of Lula. It was a bit of a, you know, the supporters called it a kind of a celebration of democracy, like a festival of democracy.
Yeah.
And that, you know, that kind of backlash, the far right backlash, didn't happen at all. So there was a little bit of, I think, maybe like a false sense of security amongst people, thinking that, you know, if it didn't happen on January 1st, then, you know, there's not going to be any sort of like capital riot style attack happening. And, you know, I think to a certain extent, they could be excused for thinking that, because what happened on Sunday was quite different from the January 6th in the US in terms of, you know, the Capitol attacks had a kind of clear objective, right, to disrupt the certification of the Biden government. But in Brazil's version, there was no clear objective because the government had already been sworn in. You know, all of these processes, all of these potential processes that they could overturn had already passed. They'd already come and gone. So this was basically just an attack and kind of widespread vandalism that had no kind of outright objective. As you said, though, there was a lot of reason, I think, for public security forces, especially in the capital, Brasilia, to expect that something was going to happen on Sunday. There was huge numbers of Bolsonaro supporters bust into the capital just days before the riots. And a lot of chat on social media about, you know, there's going to be some sort of massive protest, something was going to happen on Sunday. And the surprise, I think, from everyone else looking on was just how little security forces we saw trying to contain these protesters who turned into rioters.
Yeah. Before Lula was sworn in, there were a lot of concerns about Bolsonaro declaring that it was all rigged and then the military perhaps supporting him. It seems in hindsight that was not a real threat. So there's a lot of support for Bolsonaro as far as among the rank and file in the military, but the military establishment, the military leadership, seems like it remained loyal to the Constitution. Were those concerns at all justified, or was that always overblown?
I think it was always overblown to an extent. Because, I mean, to carry out a military coup in Brazil today, you would require support from some real higher-ups in the military. And these are people who, you know, they really never had any inclination to kind of take that plunge. Because if you, you know, if you remember recent history, Brazil was under a military dictatorship until the mid-80s. So there are elements within the army today and all the armed forces that had some sort of involvement or kind of cooperation during the military dictatorship. So it's all quite recent. And one of the key pieces of legislation that allowed for the return of democracy was a massive amnesty law in Brazil, which basically meant that all crimes committed during the dictatorship, either by armed forces or by resistance forces, would be offered amnesty. And that fits the military perfectly. I mean, that's a huge it's a huge thing for the military, because if that if things like that are start to be dug up and put on trial, then, you know, the military is in a very, very difficult position, very delicate position. So if they were to, you know, go all in on some sort of coup attempt, they would have to be sure that it would work, because if it was a failed coup attempt, then that amnesty law would be torn up and the military's image would be left in tatters. So these kind of the head honchos, as you will, I don't think there was ever really a proper argument that they would join Bolsonaro on some sort of putsch, you know.
Yeah.
But as you're right, you know, there is support for Bolsonaro among the rank and file. But I think there is also just generally the rank and file that we're talking about here doesn't necessarily mean people in the military. The rank and file that we saw on Sunday are just, you know, a lot of Bolsonaro supporters who have been basically inserted into this kind of far right social media scape where they're being lied to constantly. And they believe those lies. They're completely convinced by these lies and feel that, you know, it's an act of desperation that they have to do something to try and save their country. And, you know, it's quite sad because you see a lot of these people kind of, we're not talking about lots of, you know, like rich white people going out to try and destroy Congress. I mean, there is an element of that in the protest. They are, you know, majoritarily white, but there are also a lot of people for, you would probably class as maybe lower to middle working class, who have just essentially been brainwashed over the last, you know, 4 odd years and feel that they have to do something to save their country.
I have to tell you, this seems kind of familiar. I hate the way the American media tend to make everything about us or view the world in an American context or through lenses, a prism. But I actually think this is a story where doing that to some degree is warranted because our far right modeled this kind of clunky coup attempt. Bolsonaro and his son are both darlings of the MAGA set, and they attend CPAC conventions here. And many of the same Americans who were involved in promoting January 6th were also very open in their support of, and perhaps they coordinated with their Brazilian counterparts on January 8th. Of course, Bolsonaro immediately took off for Florida. So I wanted to just ask about some of the likenesses and differences between these two situations. The reactions from Brazil's institutions have been far more aggressive, at least in the early days, in pursuing accountability for not only the low-level brainwashed Bolsonaristas who ransacked the presidential palace and the Supreme Court, but also some of those higher up who are accused of being complicit. To what degree, and I'm going to ask for kind of some speculation on your part, to what degree do you think the fact that Brazil is still a young democracy and its democratic norms are presumably less entrenched than they are here in the U.S., to what degree do you think that shaped the response?
Yeah, it's an interesting question because I think the comparison then has to be obviously with the United States because I mean there are huge parallels to be drawn between, you know, the January 6th, January 8th. There's just 2 days in between them, obviously not a coincidence, but the way that the US reacted to that attack from where I was standing here in Brazil, it seemed to be kind of, as you mentioned, as, you know, like going through mechanisms which have been around for, you know, hundreds of years and are actually to some extent quite bloated and quite gridlocked, you know. Whereas in Brazil, you had the governor of Brasilia, or the federal district where Brasilia is located. He was given a 90-day suspension just hours after the attack had been quelled. And you even had senators issuing a request to open a congressional inquiry during the riot, which is quite unbelievable. Because, I mean, how long did it take in the US to start the hearings for January 6th? I mean, that was about maybe 18 months or something like that.
Yeah.
So the fact that Brazil is a young democracy, also the fact that Brazil is quite a, you know, for better or for worse, Brazil is a very representational democracy. I mean, it's a very fragmented situation where you have lots of parties and lots of interests involved. But at the same time, that means that you can't have, you know, some overarching force that can just basically sit on things and stop the wheels from turning, if you will. Things can move quite fast in Brazil, even from kind of minority interests. It's quite interesting to see the difference, actually, with the US.
Yeah, yeah. And just so listeners know, in addition to ordering the suspension of the governor of Brasilia, the Supreme Court has also, or the courts, I don't know if it's the Supreme Court, the courts have also ordered the arrest of the former commander of the military police, Brasilia's former public security chief, Anderson Torres, Colonel Fabio Augusto, the police commander in the federal district. Their arrests have all been ordered. The court also ordered Bolsonaro's assets to be seized. So this is a very different from what we've seen here. This is in addition to detaining 1,500 people who were involved directly in the riots. And U.S. and Brazilian lawmakers, according to Reuters, are looking for ways to, quote, cooperate on an investigation into violent protests that rampaged through Brasilia, sharing lessons from inquiries into the attack on the U.S. Capitol. Ewan, in the days following the violence, a lot of people took note of the fact that even media outlets that had been supportive of Bolsonaro and hostile toward Lula had forcefully condemned the mob. A lot of politicians who are opposed to Lula joined in. Even Bolsonaro kind of half-heartedly condemned the insurrection, although he did so with some false equivalence towards the left. Do you think that this will endure, or do you expect that tribal loyalties will ultimately lead to an embrace on the right of a narrative that they are the victims of political persecution? And I ask this because this is the pattern that we saw here. People like Kevin McCarthy, the new Speaker of the House, forcefully condemned January 6th in the days after, and now basically the entire conservative movement, most of the conservative movement, have adopted the idea that this is all about political persecution, that seeking accountability for January 6th is political persecution. Your thoughts?
Yeah, I think there is a good chance that that might happen, because quite similar to what happened in the US, at the moment, this is a time for a lot of political figures on the right to just, you know, kind of sit and take stock and see which way the wind is blowing, you know. Interestingly, we have had a few, as I mentioned earlier, a few opinion polls coming out about the support still for the idea that the election was rigged. And a suggestion that I believe it is 25% of respondents suggested that the attacks in Brasilia were somewhat justifiable. Not saying that they were justifiable or they supported them, but that there was elements of that was justifiable. So, you know, over time, I think there could emerge quite an obvious kind of constituency for some far right politicians to almost embrace the January 8th incidents, and, as you said, perhaps frame the investigations as persecution against the right, because the kind of the overarching narrative among the kind of the Bolsonarista right at the moment is that all of the, you know, all the vandalism, all of the destruction was caused by, you know, like infiltrated left wing madmen sort of thing. They weren't the ones doing it. It was all, you know, these people on the left who started the violence, and now they're all being arrested for it, which, you know, obviously is ludicrous, but is serving as the dominant narrative at the moment amongst the right. But, yeah, you know, it's just, I think it's a case of waiting to see exactly how this investigation process, how the accountability is going to happen, and who's going to be hauled up, you know, in front of judges and all that sort of thing. You know, if there is a kind of quite an effective response from the institutions, perhaps the constituency that could be favourable towards the rioters would maybe diminish. That's something that we're really going to have to wait and see.
Yeah. Listeners, if you want to check out the piece that Ewan was talking about, it's up at the Brazilian Report, which is at brazilian.report. It's about the challenges Lula will face going forward. I encourage you to check that out. Some observers say that the fact that Bolsonaro was able to incite this kind of violence against the government after Lula was sworn in is a sign of his movement's endurance and strength. Others argue that this dramatic overreach strengthens Lula's hand and also strengthens Brazil's democratic institutions. I wonder where you fall on that question. And I acknowledge that both may be true.
Yeah, I think you're right there. I think that both are true. I think Lula's hand will be strengthened in the immediate term because, you know, he's beginning his presidency now. There was already perhaps slightly more goodwill for Lula than we expected from the other branches of government. And now there certainly will be more because Congress and the judiciary, you know, they will all be happy to cooperate with him, you know, in the short term to basically hold accountable the people who committed these riots on Sunday. So that definitely works in Lula's favour. It means that he might actually get that proper honeymoon period that Brazilian presidents always used to get, but, you know, had kind of stopped receiving for a while. And I think the Bolsonaro idea there that he still holds this kind of strength because he can still, you know, even indirectly instigate followers to do something like that in the capital is valid indeed. You know, he is still the hero of the far right until someone else comes along. If there is anyone who can kind of take up the mantle on the far right in the same way that Bolsonaro has, you know, that remains to be seen. I think the problem potentially for Bolsonaro is that now he is out of office, there is going to be a lot of kind of nitpicking through his administration, finding a lot of inconsistencies, potentially uncovering scandals and matters of corruption. And that could hurt Bolsonaro, I think. You know, if the kind of the unpacking of the Bolsonaro government has really, you know, if it really does come up with something quite bombastic, then I think he could struggle to retain his post as, you know, the kind of the figure of integrity on the far right, and then you'd have to have someone else to come along and replace him. But for now, he certainly is the major figurehead on the right in Brazil.
Folks, Bolsonaro is reportedly hospitalized down in Florida at present. The Biden administration is facing some pressure to yank his visa. He came in on an A1 visa for heads of state 2 days before he was no longer the head of state. And there are also reports that Bolsonaro plans to return to Brazil and essentially dare authorities to try to hold him accountable for inciting this violence. Ewan Marshall, I believe we are about out of time. I want to thank you so much for speaking with us today. I really do appreciate it.
No problem. That was great. Thanks.
Folks, stay tuned. We're going to take a quick break and then come right back with Heather Digby Parton. It's been one hell of a night. Broken sidewalks, power lines. Your words buzzing through my mind. Oh, I pray you'll see the signs. Oh, my. These whiskey.
never gonna tell the truth. Oh, my mind, no man, no cry. I'll never give my heart to you. Oh, light 'em up like a tin cup. Yeah, love 'em then I let 'em down. Oh, light 'em up like a tin cup. Yeah, love 'em then I let 'em down. Heart beat in my veins. I keep running from the flames. Every tear screams, stay away. Tell me, will I ever change? I'll never change.
And we are back. I am always pleased to welcome my next guest. Heather Digby Parton is a columnist at Salon. She is also the proprietrix of her own blog, Hullabaloo. Heather, welcome back to We've Got Issues.
Thanks for having me. Glad to be here. Happy New Year.
Thanks for taking the time. Happy New Year to you. Let's see where to begin. So Kevin McCarthy won the speakership after folding to the right-wing Freedom Caucus on all of their demands. It's funny, he has been portrayed as kind of a moderate member of the GOP establishment by the political press, which has a kernel of truth to it, but I think people forget that he leveraged the hard right Tea Party movement to gain a leadership position in the first place in 2013. So he is like Dr. Frankenstein and has no control over the monster he helped create.
That's absolutely true. I mean, he is a member of the establishment, but the establishment is, you know, batshit crazy.
Wing nutty,
so,
yeah.
So, exactly. You know, that's correct. And his history in that is very interesting because it has happened over and over. This is the second time that he enabled, encouraged, you know, and inspired the right-wing crazies in the Freedom Caucus. He did that back in 2013, as you point out, and they stabbed him in the back in 2015 when he was next in line for the speakership.
Yeah,
they impaled him. And so he spent the next 8 years, I guess, you know, doing everything in his power to ensure that that would not happen again, and that he would have these people, you know, he had proved to them that he had their backs. He, you know, basically all of his Trump, you know, machinations over the past 5 years have been partially in service of that goal of his, which is to become Speaker of the House. And a lot of good it did him. I mean, in the end, he won. But my God, you know, what an ugly process it was, and it's a Pyrrhic victory because he's probably not going to last. I wouldn't give him 6 months in the job. They won the ability to take him out in you know, with only one member coming forward with a move to vacate the chair. And if he doesn't do what they want, they can get rid of him, and they can get rid of him even if he does do what they want. I mean, that's the thing about these people. They could do it just for a power play if they had somebody else lined up that they could, you know, that they could replace him with. So it's a very Pyrrhic victory for him. And I, you know, couldn't happen to a nicer guy.
Yeah. Oh, I hear you. I wonder, so obviously we're in for 2 years of absolutely ridiculous clownishness and also dangerous hostage taking by the Republicans. But here's the question that I have. Do you think there's a chance that their lack of constraint, that the fact that they are being very open about the fact that they're going to just Benghazi everything and not even try to govern in a serious way, could that make it more likely that they actually lose leverage, that the far right loses leverage on stuff like the debt limit or aid to Ukraine? Because at some point, I wonder if their antics make it easier for McCarthy to say, fuck it, I'm going to get 20 Democrats to vote for this budget or whatever it is and run around the QAnon caucus. And keep in mind that they need to depose him. They need to have unity within their caucus.
Right. Well, the Democrats could help if they wanted to. I mean, it all the dynamics are very interesting on that. If the Democrats saw an opening, he did something, you know, that they wanted to exert their power in this situation, they could involve themselves in that. I doubt that would happen, but it is possible. This narrow margin is very, very difficult. And it, you know, Nancy Pelosi and her caucus made it look easy. Yeah. But that's because they had two things going. I mean, the Democrats had a big agenda that they wanted to get passed, and the House was more or less unified on that agenda. There wasn't a whole lot of dissension. If anything, it was, you know, go bigger. Not, you know, they weren't trying to restrain them in any way from doing things. So, you know, that helped. And there was also, I think, just the shell shock of the 4 years of Donald Trump and the craziness of January 6th and the fact that the party has gone so far to the right that, you know, they've fallen off the edge. That unified the Democrats as well. There was a sobering aspect to, you know, hey, look, let's just, you know, get the job done here because these people are nuts. But they made it look easy, but it is not going to be easy. It's not going to be easy. And I am interested in what you say. I have thought of that too and wondered whether or not it just reaches a point where there's enough of the Republican caucus that just is, you know, they become, well, two things. One, they get afraid that they're going to lose big in 2024. If the polling on these antics is bad,
yes,
you know, that is going to have an effect. If their own voters start saying, wait a minute, this is ridiculous, that's a possibility. The other is that, you know, they feel the need on some sort of just a basic power level to fight back on these big issues like the debt ceiling and, you know, aid to Ukraine, which I think a lot of the Republicans actually, I mean, I think it's 50%, isn't it, of the Republicans that are for aid to Ukraine. So that could
I think
be
it's higher in the Congress, though.
Yeah,
that's
among
voters. Yeah, I think it's higher in the Congress.
Right. That could be. But I mean, there could be enough there that could make that more difficult. And the debt ceiling, of course, you're going to have some people with a lot of money pounding them hard on that. Now, that doesn't affect the Freedom Caucus because they have their own source of funding and their own base of you know,
they're also
voters.
Heavily gerrymandered districts.
They're safe. I mean, they don't care about any of that. They've put all the nuts into these gerrymandered districts.
Yeah, that's right.
So they're not going to be reachable. But it is possible in that situation that some of the other ones. So, you know, to be honest with you, I have no idea. I mean, I think this is going to be on those big issues like that. I think it's going to be very, very, very difficult. And I think it's going to be ugly. And you just have to kind of hope that sanity prevails there because, I don't know, I mean, I had the idea of the discharge petition, which, you know, everybody's been talking about, that maybe the Democrats and some, there have been a couple of, I think, New York-based swing district Republicans who've been sort of saying, well, maybe we could get together with the Democrats to do a discharge petition on the debt ceiling. But from everything I'm reading, that is a hugely heavy, heavy lift. Because it takes a long time to do discharge petitions and debt ceiling negotiations by the definition tend to move quickly and they're very dynamic. And so this isn't a particularly useful way to do it, but it's a possibility. You know, I mean, it is something that maybe could be done, but we're looking at a big mess. I mean, let's just face it. This is going to be a big mess. But can I just make one point about that? It was always going to be a big mess. It had nothing to do with McCarthy's deals that he gave away. I mean, it's important that it should be important to the Republicans that he gave away the store to these nuts on important committees, on things like that, because every seat he gave to them, he took away from some establishment or, you know, less somebody with more seniority or whatever. I mean, he really, you know, stabbed in the back a lot of his own people in making those deals. But the deals on the debt ceiling and the stuff about entitlements and the stuff about spending caps and term limits and all this other crazy junk that they apparently negotiated in the, you know, Chip Roy and the rest of them were in there negotiating on that. That was going to happen anyway, whether or not they did it or not. The minute that we found out that this was going to be a very narrow margin in the House and Kevin McCarthy or whomever got the job was going to be dealing with these nuts, we knew what they were going to do because they've done it before. And now they have a lot more leverage. So this is what they do.
Yeah, that's right. by the way, I feel like, and this is weird, I was not a supporter of Joe Biden's candidacy in the primaries, but he has a certain coolness, and I actually think he's probably the best person to deal with this craziness in the House. I don't, maybe that's wishful thinking. By the way, McCarthy said that his caucus was going to be a model of transparency, which is generally a joke. But I just want to point out that many Republican lawmakers, not in the crazy caucus, are in the dark about the details of the deal he cut with people like Chip Roy and Matt Gaetz and all those bunch. There may or may not be, according to reports, a 3-page document laying out the terms of that agreement, but Republican lawmakers that are not in on that deal can't even verify the existence of the document. Also, the new House's first bill is based entirely on a right-wing lie that the IRS is set to hire 87,000 new agents, or maybe armed agents, depending on who you talk to or who you're right-wing uncle watches, Fox or Newsmax. And the Congressional Budget Office has scored their proposal and found that it would add $100 billion to the federal deficit by letting tax cheats get away with it. So their first move would drive up the deficit to protect wealthy tax cheats based on some stupid right-wing propaganda, which seems very, very much on brand. Okay, so far it seems that Democrats are pushing back against the craziest parts of this, the select committee to investigate the politicization of the DOJ. They have framed that as a body devoted to covering up the crimes of Trump and other insurrectionists. How do you rate their chances of taking the Republicans' like inevitable overreach and making it into a story of corruption? Because that was very effective in 2006.
I think there's a good possibility that that's going to happen. I mean, for one thing, I mean, the idea that they're claiming that this is, you know, we're doing this as a, you know, it's a reconstitution of the Church Committee, which back in the 70s was a bipartisan committee that, you know, took a good hard look at the CIA and the rest of the intelligence community. And after, you know, years of abuse, right?
Yeah.
And it was a bipartisan committee, and you know, it did reveal certain things and created some reforms. Reforms, by the way, which, you know, were eroded quite, you know, greatly over time, and particularly yeah. after 9/11, when everybody just, you know, threw up their hands and went, do what you want, you know. So, you know, in a sense, I mean, it would be, if they were serious about this, this wouldn't be a bad idea, you know, doing it. I think a lot of progressives have been talking about doing a new church committee for probably the last 25 years, saying, you know, look, we need to go back and take another look at what's going on with the, you know, with the intelligence community. It's you know, it operates in secret. It's important to take a look at it. And there were definitely abuses over the course of the war on terror and the rest of it. But that's not what they're doing. And we know that what they're doing here, this is purely, I'm calling it the Vengeance Commission. I mean, it's all about going back to look at the investigations into Donald Trump and the, you know, the Russia investigation, the various criminal, you know, probes that came up about him and are currently, you know, coming up about him, to look at not only the CIA, but look at the FBI and the Department of Justice in general. And, you know, they're not even really trying to hide that, right? I mean, this is, you know, the weaponization of the deep state is their excuse. And I think everybody can see through it. And because if you look at the clowns that are going to be running this stuff and the way that they present this, you know, it'd be one thing if they could bring themselves to come up with a sort of a format like the January 6th committee, you know, something where, you know, it's very serious and well produced and put together and everybody's, you know, very sober about the whole thing. But you know, that's not what's going to happen. I mean, you know, they're going to put Marjorie Taylor Greene on the committee, I'm sure. So I think you're right. I mean, I think that there's a good chance that it will be overreach. And I, you know, I don't think that that's going to work well for them in the current environment. I mean, what we saw in the last three elections, really, is that, you know, there's a majority in the country, even in the swing states, that are just very leery of this behavior. And I really think that's a lot of it. It's the behavior. It's the way that they are going about things, as if they're living in, as if the whole country is, you know, living in, you know, in Fox News world, and it's just not true. And they don't know that. I don't think that they know that. So I think overreach is a very, you know, very, very distinct possibility.
Yeah. I mean, in this world, there are three things that are certain, and it's death, taxes, and right-wing overreach. I think the biggest obstacle for pushing back on this, and by the way, this select committee is also going to look at Elon Musk's stupid Twitter files propaganda.
Okay.
Right? It's a clown show. But I think the biggest obstacle for Democrats in pushing back against this with a kind of narrative, an accurate narrative about what they're doing, wasting tax dollars, chasing after bullshit, is the legacy media's normalcy bias and endless efforts to both sides at everything. The Washington Post has an opinion column today titled, and I quote, "In today's rowdy GOP, could Jim Jordan be the adult in the room?" Which is like,
oh my God,
what the fuck are you talking about? Are you crazy? Like, this is crazy. Oh, it's so crazy. Yeah. Now, speaking of lazy both sides journalism, I'm going to change gears a little bit here. I cannot begin to describe my annoyance at the revelations that Joe Biden's attorneys found some classified documents among his old records and immediately turned them over to the National Archives, which is what you're supposed to do. We're recording this on Thursday, the day that Attorney General Merrick Garland appointed a special counsel to look into this controversy. Garland continues to be, or appears to be, extremely sensitive to bad faith claims from the right. Heather, do you think there is a single reporter or editor in the entire world, anywhere in the ostensibly neutral mainstream media, who actually thinks this situation is comparable to Trump overseeing the removal of boxes of classified documents, then ignoring requests to return them, then ignoring subpoenas, and actively moving them around to avoid detection? Do they believe it?
Of course not. They know that this is ridiculous. They know it. But their whole point here, this is an opportunity for them to show that they're just straight down the line, unbiased reporters who just, you know, call it as they see it. And here we have Joe Biden, and he's raising questions.
Raising questions.
What was he doing with them? What were they there for? What was going on? Who brought them there? And they haven't been forthcoming. I mean, to me, this is just like, you know, the junk about Hillary Clinton and, you know, and the emails and the rest of this. I mean, this is what they do in order to prove, maybe to themselves as much as anything, that they are unbiased. They know this is nonsense. They know that, look, I'm sure that you've been saying the same thing I have from the moment that this happened with Trump last summer and they did the search at Mar-a-Lago. Which is that, you know, the reason that there are suspicions about this is because of the way he acted. It would have been perfectly reasonable for him to just say, when the National Archives came along and said, look, we're missing some of these documents. We think you have them. Can you please search your stuff and bring them back? And if he'd have said, oh, geez, sorry, you know, well, he could never say sorry, but, you know, he'd say, fine, we packed in a hurry. And I will have my people look through and we will send back anything we find that is classified there. That would have been the end of it.
That would have been absolutely the end of it. A one-day story, no calls for prosecution. Everybody knows this.
Yeah, I mean, everybody knows that the problem isn't, I mean, you know, sure, it's curious why he had them and the fact that, but that what made it a scandal is the fact that he refused to turn them, give them back, and claimed that, you know, was going around, I can declassify anything I want, and blah, 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 and going through this. Then they came down there, they talked to them, they negotiated, they finally had to issue a subpoena, and finally a warrant in order to get them back. Now, that is suspicious behavior. I'm sorry.
Yeah.
What Joe Biden did is that, you know, they found some stuff, they immediately called the National Archives and went, oh, gee, it looks like we accidentally have some classified documents here, like, you know, send somebody over to pick them up. which they did. And then they went and searched around and went, gee, I wonder if there are any more. And they went and searched around and did exactly the same thing. I mean, that is now, you know, I suppose that, you know, you can make a big deal out of the fact that they both had classified information. It's not good that they did, but this is not uncommon, according to all the experts say, you know, look, sometimes this happens. There's a lot of classified documents in, if you're working in the executive branch in those areas, there are a lot of them. And most, you know, there's overclassification of a lot of stuff. And maybe some of the stuff that Biden had from 2014 or whatever, they might not even be classified anymore. They just had classified markings on them. But whatever, that's not really the point. It wouldn't have raised any suspicions either way if Trump had done what any normal person would have done in that situation.
But let me add something to this.
You know,
let me add something to that point. It's not just that. Yes, context matters. And there is this very annoying habit of a lot of political reporters to pretend that they cannot recognize any context, that they can't recognize obvious differences between things. It's not just the way that Trump behaved when it was unearthed that he had these classified documents. But going back all the way to the 2016 campaign, when his campaign had dozens and dozens of covert contacts with Russian operatives, when he's like giving away Israeli intelligence, the most sensitive Israeli intelligence to visitors in the Oval Office, like he's always played loose and fast with intelligence materials, which is not the case with normal people, Joe Biden or anybody else really in the White House that we've seen that I can recall. And, you know, it's just like, it's very frustrating that we're all going to pretend that these things are in any way comparable when it's just so clear that they aren't. And it's really tiring. It's tiring to always have to deal with this bullshit. And one other point, the reporters who are pretending, who are trying to be fair and pretending that there is some issue here, a real issue, they will never get any credit from the people who claim that they are the fake media and that they are biased towards the left. They'll never get any credit. There's no point in this.
There is no point. And I mean, I think back, you know, when you go back, it goes all the way back to the 60s and 70s when they started this, you know, liberal media bias, you know, mantra, which they have used to great effect to pressure the mainstream media. But those days are gone. That, you know, that they could that it meant anything, right? I mean, because Fox News and Newsmax and OAN and the rest of them, they live in an alternate universe. They're never going to give any credit. And they get great mileage out of this idea that it's the fake news media. Some guy was on CNN, some representative, and saying, well, I'm on the Clinton News Network for the first time. It's like, well, you know, come on, dude. You know, but this is that it means nothing for them to, you know, insist upon this idea of neutrality and we're just calling it straight. You know, they gain nothing from it. And if anything, they kind of lose, I think, because I think that there's a whole audience out there, the audience that actually watches them and reads their papers, that knows exactly the game that's being played and thinks the less of them. It causes them to be disrespected by their own readers and their own audience because you see it and you're going, give me a break. You know, you're doing this, really? I mean, I think that's been the reaction across the board to this latest one, and it's typical. You know, I mean, there's no nuance in any of this. There's no ability, as you say, to provide context. And as a result, now, you know, now we've got a special prosecutor. I mean, they're all dancing and, you know, the media's gone nuts on this. And, you know, of course, it's a Republican special prosecutor, by the way, or at least one that was appointed by Donald Trump. So, you know, we're doing that again as well. There's no such thing as a Democratic special prosecutor, as far as I know. I don't think there's ever been one. I mean, who was the last one? Archibald Cox, I think, was the last one. and we know what happened to him. So, but anyway,
Okay. Well, Heather, I believe we are about out of time, but I want to thank you so much for taking the time to speak with me today. I really appreciate it.
My pleasure. Thanks so much for having me.
I would also like to thank Ewan Marshall and David Edwards, our producer and engineer. I'd like to thank the good folks at Alternet and Raw Story for supporting the show. You can follow me on Mastodon. You can subscribe to the show wherever you get your podcasts. Of course, I would like to thank all of you fine people for tuning in. Have a terrific week.